This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Would you like to trim your energy bill? I'm hearing lots of absolutelys. Are you interested in reducing your impact on the environment? Yes. Well, our guest this afternoon is here to help. Her name is Jennifer Thorne Amon, and she is with the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy. And she's also one of the authors of The Consumer Guide to Home Energy Savings. The guide, now in its 9th edition, offers consumers information and advice on saving money on big ticket and small ticket items. It offers suggestions on where to begin and what to aim for long term. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Jennifer Thorne Amon. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Jennifer Thorne Amon is a senior associate in the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy. The publication Consumer Guide to Home Energy Savings, published by New Society Publishers, and you'll find a condensed online version of the guide at this website, www.acee.org/consumer guide, and we'll give that website again later in the program, and we'll also put a link to it on our website at will.illinois.edu. So listeners, we look forward to your questions. Join us with a telephone call, 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks so much for having me, Celeste.
Sure. Would you tell us here at the outset just a little bit about your organization, the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy?
Sure. ACEE has been around for about 27 years, and we were founded to provide policymakers and consumers and other energy users with better information on how to improve energy efficiency. We really believe that energy efficiency is about the best tool we have for improving the environment and ensuring economic prosperity as we move forward. And over those 27 years, certainly the challenges have grown as we have had a growing recognition of the impacts that we're having and our energy use is having on global climate and other issues regarding energy supplies and just our growing population and growing energy demands. And we do that by educating consumers through avenues like the Consumer Guide and our consumer-related information on the web. We also do a lot of work within the utility industry and with the federal government and state government. And we look at ways to improve efficiency not only in buildings but also in transportation, in the industrial sector, and through the utility sector itself.
Okay, very interesting. I took a quick look at the website, and there's all kinds of advice there for consumers. Very handy resource. We have had a warm autumn here in Illinois and in Indiana, but the heating season is here, and tonight some of our listening area will experience overnight lows in the 20s. Mm-hmm. So I think it would be a very nice place to begin this afternoon with some tips on cutting heating bills.
Yeah, I think we've all been lulled into maybe not thinking about the coming winter with this very mild fall that we've had, but we are having projections that in the Midwest increases in heating costs of 11% this winter, given increases in natural gas prices and the projections for the weather. So it is a really timely issue. And I think the main thing to do is to start off by doing an assessment of your home and taking whatever steps you can to reduce the ability for the cold winter air to even get into your home. And that means sealing, insulating, and kind of making those main steps. And so you can start off by just doing a quick review of your home. Take a stick of incense or something where you can see if you'll see the smoke blowing, and go around and find the drafts in your home. And some of the most obvious places, of course, are going to be around windows and doors, around the framing, and then the window and door itself. But also areas around your baseboards. You might have some gaps that are letting air in.
Mm-hmm.
Around any other kind of open hole or point of access in your walls, on exterior walls, and that can include light switches, power outlets, any place where you may have a plumbing penetration coming in, particularly like in your bathroom, you may have something.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go to your hardware store, you can pick up for low cost a whole range of products that are very simple and anybody could install themselves to help cut all those drafts. And that's different types of weather stripping, door sweeps, different types of caulking products, all made for these different applications. They even have little foam insulators that are made to fit right inside your light switches and your power outlets, and you just unscrew those, put the foam piece in, all the holes are already cut in, so you'll be able to put the wall plate right back on and plug back in anything that you had. So all of those are quick, easy, and very inexpensive ways to get started in reducing your heating load in this winter.
Yeah, and we can do that this weekend, if not tonight, if we get on the ball once we get home.
Yeah, absolutely.
The outlet thing, that is a great thing. A couple of years ago, I did that, and it's very interesting how it makes such a difference. And there's also those little plugs that go into the outlet.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got an outlet you're not using, plug it up. Makes a small difference, but it is a difference. And then the rope caulk is excellent for around those gaps.
Yeah, and all these little things, they can really add up, you know. And the nice thing about it is it's something quick that you could do this winter, and it's going to save you energy year-round. It'll save during the winter. It'll also save in the summer when you're air conditioning your home, and it's going to save you money year in and year out over time. And then the other thing that that a lot of consumers can do, if you've got some storm windows, you may have them tucked away in your cellar or out in a shed somewhere. You want to bring those out. Now is the great time to get out before it gets too cold and go ahead and install your storm windows. And if you don't have permanent, you know, those the more hardy storm windows,
mm-hmm.
doesn't mean that you have to run out this year. If it's, you know, it may not be in the cards for you to go out and make that kind of investment this year. You can buy at any hardware store, along with the other weather stripping products, you'll find plastic sheeting that you can very easily install on the inside of your windows. You can use a blow dryer so it kind of shrink wraps it to the window so it won't impact your visibility through the window too much. And those things, you know, I think a lot of people, you know, say to me, oh, you've got to be kidding. How much of a difference could that make? But it really can make a big difference. The only concern with that is you want to make sure you're going to do that at the, you know, once the weather really does change and you won't be wanting to open your windows because you'll have to leave the windows closed for the year. But then that stuff, you can just peel it right off when spring rolls around and you'll never know it was there.
What about window treatments on the inside, insulating shades and drapery?
Mm-hmm. All of that can make a really big impact, particularly if you have heavy draperies. And now on the market are a lot of different types of shades that do a really great job of providing an insulating layer to help. Again, what they're really going to do is help create another layer that will keep out the cold air but also keep the warm air in that's in your house in. But one thing with shades and blinds, what you'll want to do, if you have a window that gets good access to lots of sunlight during the day, open those blinds during the day, let the sun pour in, let that heat from the sun come in and heat up the items in your room. That can make a really big difference. And then once the evening comes, pull those shades, kind of trap that heat inside and block the evening's cold outside.
Yeah. Another thing you recommend is a programmable thermostat. Does that beat turning the heat down when you go to bed and up when you get out of bed? When you come home, you turn it up. When you leave your home, you turn it down.
Yeah, you know, the programmable thermostat is kind of an interesting case because it can't save energy by itself. And if you're somebody who is very, very diligent about setting the temperature forward and backward yourself manually, you're not going to save additional energy by using a programmable thermostat. But if you're somebody who forgets to do that or would just like the convenience of having the system do it for you, then a programmable thermostat can really help you out. And, you know, I think in the past we used to recommend, you know, if you had teenagers around, maybe you could put a programmable thermostat on and it would just run the system and they wouldn't be as tempted to go in and, you know, make the changes. But now all our kids are more technically savvy than we are, so I don't think it does much good anymore. But, you know, certainly you could teach them how to use it.
Yeah, you can have them program it for you.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it might help, you know, if you go and you see the program is running, it's operating the way it should, maybe you won't be tempted to make those kind of quick changes and adjustments to the temperature to because, you know, you feel like it's just not getting warm enough fast enough. But, you know, if you aren't diligent about doing the setback yourself or you want the convenience, a programmable thermostat is certainly a great idea. And, you know, now the products that are on the market can make it very easy for you to set up a different schedule for the weekdays and the weekends.
Mm-hmm.
Some models will even allow you to make different settings for each day of the week, which can be great. Now I know people have much more flexible and very different schedules. People may even work at home some days and in the office others. So you can set that up to really work with you and the schedule that your family has. And that can really save energy. Doing the setback, you're going to save, you know, 1-2% on your heating bill for each degree of setback, particularly if that setback is for, you know, 7 to 8 hours. So overnight while you're sleeping and during the day while you're away at the office, having a setback, you know, particularly if you can go down to 60 degrees or so, can make a really big impact.
Yeah, very big impact. One of the things that is interesting to think about, you know, when you're thinking about saving money on the heating bill is that heating is the largest energy expense in most homes. So if you can reduce that, you know, you can do what you can, you're going to save a lot of money.
Absolutely. And one other thing I would just point out with many of the things that we've been talking about in terms of sealing up your home, another thing you might want to do if you're not sure about the insulation levels in your house, it certainly makes sense to have a contractor come out and help you figure out if you have adequate insulation, particularly in your basement and in your attic, and if not, beef up those insulation levels. But all of these investments, not only do they pay off in lower energy costs, but when it comes time to replace your furnace or a boiler, you may be able to get by with a smaller unit because you will have reduced your home's heating load.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Jennifer Thorne Amon. She's with the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy, or ACEEE. She's also one of the authors of the Consumer Guide to Home Energy Savings. Listeners, if you'd like to join us this afternoon, if you've got a question about home energy savings, give us a call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now, a listener on a cell phone, line one. Hi.
Hi, I'm coming in the middle of discussion, and it sounds like you've got all kinds of great ideas, you know, for insulating your home and making it energy efficient. And I guess I'm wondering, like, if you listen to Amory Lovins talking about his home at the Rocky Mountain Institute, it's like he says he loses, and he's in Colorado, up in the mountains, like less than a degree a day just by, you know, it's the sunshine, but it's also that his house is super insulated. And I wonder if you took all of the tips that you're giving together, how close can you get to that kind of efficiency? And what can you do about, like, increasing the insulation in your walls or anything else to come and approach that type of thing? It seems like rather than building new homes that are super insulated, which is a great idea, most people aren't in that position. They need to work with what they have, and I just wonder, how far can you get us?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, and it will depend, of course, on the condition of the house that you live in. And I've actually been out to the Rocky Mountain Institute, and it's a beautiful facility. And I think we all wish that we could do the things that they've managed to do. I was out there in December, and they had ripe tomatoes growing in the middle of the house. It was really quite impressive. But, you know, they really have the, you know, they've got the resources and the time to focus on, you know, nothing but making that building as energy efficient as possible. But what can the average consumer do? And, you know, there's a lot that you can do. We have, we've done some analysis and looking at a number of, you know, kind of basic upgrades that people can do to their existing homes that can get you in the area of 25 to 40% reduction in your overall energy use. If you were willing to invest, you know, to be honest, a few thousand, many thousands more, you could cut your energy more than 50%. But
sure,
there are things that you can do and that are accessible to any homeowner. And certainly insulation is a great way to get started. I think most homes would be well-served to add insulation in their attic. In your walls, it may seem like it's not feasible to beef up insulation levels unless you're doing a remodeling project where you're going to be opening your walls up, but that's not true. There's a whole range of insulation products that can be blown into place and fill in the cavities in your walls from the outside, and that's certainly something to look into and talk with an insulation contractor about what can be done in your own home.
One follow-up is if you have, I happen to know I've got fiberglass bats in the walls, and it sounds like you might be suggesting that I could additionally blow in, like, cellulose or something on top of that.
What you would want to do is have a contractor come out and look, because depending on how the bats have been installed, you may be able to benefit from some additional insulation being blown in. And the nice thing about the blown-in insulation is, you know, by blowing it in, you can imagine how we can get into some of the gaps and places where those fiberglass bats just, you know, you can't be cut to fit into every single gap. So you can, so there are a number of products that can be used that way. There are different types of things that can be used. You know, we're seeing some really interesting products being used for insulation these days, including, you know, a lot of different types of organic products. Even organic cotton is being used in
wow,
some applications for, so now's actually a great time. There are so many more products available, and the contractors have more experience. And I would, tell everyone to contact your local utility, and they should be able to help you find qualified contractors that can come out and help you assess your home and give you these ideas. And the great thing about it is, even if you're thinking, you know, I don't know if that's an investment I can make right now, it makes sense to have somebody come out and give you a good, thorough assessment of your property. And then what you can do is you can start planning for those investments and thinking about what you would need to do over the next 1, 2, 3 years and how you can work it into your budget to make those upgrades over time, because all of it's going to pay off in the long run.
Okay, thanks very much.
Yeah, sure.
You're welcome. Next, we talk with a listener in Urbana on line 2. Hi.
Hi. I wanted to recommend an old book which a friend loaned me, and I found a used copy on, it was probably at Amazon.com. It's called Movable Insulation. It's from 1980, but it seems to have lots of good ideas. It's a guide to reducing heating and cooling losses through the windows in your home. The title, again, is Movable Insulation. I'm sure it's out of print, but there are used copies around. And there might be something that's more contemporary, but lots of good ideas. I'm always intrigued at how resistant we are to changing some of our habits. For instance, whether or not you pre-wash dishes before you put them in the dishwasher. Whenever guests come over and have dinner here, they want to help load up the dishwasher, and I say, you can only do that if you promise not to wash them before you put them in the dishwasher. I mean, what's the point of having a dishwasher if you're going to wash them ahead of time? And they say, well, I'm just rinsing them. Well, just scrape off any big pieces of food. It's a dishwasher. It's supposed to do a good job, and as long as you don't overload it, it does fine. Things like that add up. Having, you know, all these little lights on various things, having all these little boxes of little transformers that are part of power supplies for a lot of things, those all use energy, and they're on, whether or not you're actually drawing power through them.
Yeah.
You can feel the heat that's the energy that's being transformed into heat. If you touch them and they feel warm, they're using energy. All those things add up, and I think we really need to think about those things. With the water deal, we also have to think about, you know, if we keep having more and more people, we're going to need more and more water for them, and we need to think about conserving water as well as the energy to heat the water. And the other one more thing I wanted to say was that if we think in terms of the bigger energy picture, not just what we're using in our household, I read somewhere that it takes that one aluminum can, recycling one aluminum can, saves enough electricity to power a television set for 3 hours. And if we can recycle or reduce what we bring in, reuse what we can cut down on the number of power plants that need to be built. And all those things add to our costs if we have to have these new power plants and have the pollution, et cetera. So that's my little soapbox. Take care.
Okay, thanks for the word this afternoon on that, on conservation and habits. That's a really important point, isn't it, Jennifer?
Oh, absolutely. And so what we've tried to do in the book and online, we also have some information, is really helping people figure out not just what to buy when you're out in the market for new energy-using appliances and things, but how to use what you already have to make the most of it, to reduce its energy consumption, to think a little bit about ways that you can incorporate more conservation into your daily life. And in the book and on the website, we also have links to other organizations that are talking about sustainability in a larger way, as the caller was talking about, thinking a little bit more about the impact of all of your purchasing decisions. So while we don't have the space to focus on that in the book, we recognize the importance of it. We talk about it a little bit, and we try to provide some resources to help people that are looking in that direction. And I would just, you know, I was laughing as she was talking about the dishwasher. I think that's something that we all struggle with. And people come to me all the time and say, well, you know, I just don't think my dishwasher can get the dishes clean. And I always encourage everyone to pick up Consumer Reports and look at the ratings and the discussion of dishwashers, because they will tell you that pretty much any dishwasher on the market today can get your dishes clean even if you don't rinse them off first. And I know that it took me a long time, and I live and breathe this stuff, and it was very difficult for me to break the habit that I had been raised with, that you had to rinse the dishes before they go into the dishwasher.
Yeah.
But our dishwashers today use, it's almost unfathomable that they can clean dishes with as little water as they do.
And I understand that they can actually, the new line of dishwashers, the new lines of dishwashers can actually do a better job with less energy than I can standing at the sink doing the dishes.
Yeah, studies show that unless you are just, you know, incredibly, incredibly frugal in your washing habits, you will save energy and water by using a dishwasher instead of washing dishes by hand.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we encourage people to do. And the thing that I love about the dishwashing example is, you know, people talk about a lot of conservation efforts and things that you have to do, you know, taking away your convenience or causing more work. But here's something where, you know, we're working really hard to convince people to do something that's easier, that saves them their own human time and energy, and let the machine do the work. And so it's an interesting example, because it goes, you know, how it cuts both ways.
Okay, let's go next to a listener on line 4 in Indiana. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Fine. You were talking about the programmable temperature controls and so forth. And at one time, there was considerable arguments back and forth about the fact that if I turned the heat source down during the day, that it took more energy to heat that air back up again to the normal temperature than it would be to try to leave it at the same level all the time. In other words, say 68 or 65, whatever, and just leave it set at that versus they take it down, take it back up, and so forth. Has there been any more studies done to show that it is better to let it cycle up and down as your usage, or to let it just stay at the same level?
Great question.
Yeah, that's something that we hear a lot about, and you know, I think it's one of those kind of lingering, almost, you know, I'd categorize it with some of the other myths we have about energy use. A lot of the studies now have shown that really, you know, unless you're only gone for a couple of hours, if you're going to be gone for more than 4 to 6 hours and you have that setback in place, you're really going to save energy by cutting back and letting the system work harder to bring the temperature back up in time for you to get home or wake up in the morning, you know, whatever the situation may be. Many of the systems are designed to operate very efficiently at their full, when they're working full out. So, you know, it's not going to use more energy, and in fact, they can work very efficiently when they're, you know, kind of really pushing it. So you're going to save energy by doing the setback and then letting the system work hard to bring your home back up to the temperature that you would like to have it at. There's one thing that I would mention, just because I know some people in your listening area do use heat pumps for heating.
Mm-hmm.
And one important thing is if you're going to go out and buy a programmable thermostat and you use a heat pump system, you want to make sure that you buy a thermostat that's designed to work specifically with heat pumps, because they operate a little bit differently, and so they need to take a longer period of time to bring the temperature up in your home, because if you a regular system can kind of be operating at that lower temperature, you know, say in the low 60s, and then all of a sudden get a call to raise the temperature to 68, and it can just work hard to get you there. But a heat pump needs to, over time, slowly raise the temperature a couple of degrees at a time to avoid relying solely on the electric resistance backup heat that's inside of a heat pump. And you really want to avoid that. So you just have to make sure you've got the right thermostat if you're using a heat pump.
Okay. Does the caller want to follow up?
There was one other additional thing. There's some new brands of furnaces out. I'm not going to name any of them, but that they run on a very low level. It's kind of like when they used to have the 8-cylinder Cadillac cars where they ran on 8 cylinders, in some cases 6 sometimes, and if you were just cruising on 4. They have furnaces now that kind of step themselves up. Mm-hmm. Would the programmable heat control mess that up, or is that something that will still work both ways?
Yeah, the systems are all designed to work together. So I think you're talking about like a variable speed type of product. And the programmable thermostats should be able to work just fine with that kind of system. And if you have any questions about it and you're getting a new furnace, you may just want to talk to your contractor to make sure everything's compatible.
Okay. I want to thank the listener for his call. Next, we go to Urbana, a listener on line one. Hi.
Hi. Yes, my question is regarding my dryer. Our clothes dryer of about 15 years or so has completely and totally died, and we've repaired it several times. So now we think we better just get probably a new one. And I was reading in Consumer Reports, I think it was effective January 1st of this year, that there were new governmental regulations to be about 22% more efficient. I don't have a computer that's up and going, but do you have, or could you direct me to some that are efficient and yet not too highly priced that might be good? And then the second part of my question is, what do you think of the high-efficiency clothes washers that wash with very little water and require high-efficiency detergents? So first one is the dryer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, actually, the changes in the federal energy requirements that took effect earlier this year were for clothes washers. There aren't currently standards for clothes dryers, and that's actually something that there have just started to be meetings on getting into place some regulations to look at clothes dryers and to create a minimum energy efficiency rating for clothes dryers. But there are a couple things you can do, I'd have to say. Unfortunately, I don't think there haven't been very great improvements in dryer energy use probably since you bought your old dryer 15 years ago. There are a couple of things that are new that you can look for when you buy a new dryer. What you'll want to look for is a unit that has a moisture sensor And, you know, a number of years ago, the first sensors that were introduced used temperature as a gauge for when to shut off the dryer. And that was a good first step. But the new systems that use moisture sensors are able to cut off the dryer much closer to the time when the clothes are just getting dry. And that's one way to save energy. And that's really about the best that you can do right now. So if you're out in the market, you just want to look for a unit that has a moisture sensor, and you'll know that you're getting among the more efficient products. And other than that, there's not a whole lot of difference in their energy consumption. Clothes washers, on the other hand, is a place where we've made tremendous gains in energy efficiency. And one of the really interesting things about the new clothes washers is one of the ways that they get us a lot of energy savings is that they're able to spin the clothes much faster than older washers did. And that means much less water left in the clothes at the end of the wash cycle, so you're saving energy in the dryer because it takes less time to dry the clothes. That also means less wear and tear on the clothes in the dryer and also less time for drying. So there are a lot of good benefits there. The new clothes washers that are on the market now, a lot of their energy savings comes from the fact that they use significantly less water. So that's a really great thing because you're getting resource savings on both energy and water. And many parts of the country are, you know, have water restraints, issues with water shortages. We're seeing, you know, a drought through the southeast. And then other parts of the country have had really large increases in water and sewer costs over the last several years. So that's another opportunity for savings. Most of the more efficient units on the market, or the most efficient clothes washers you'll find, are the front loaders. And so I would encourage people to take a look if you haven't owned a front loader in the past. Look at what's available and consider whether one might meet your needs. I know I love mine. I wouldn't give it up. But if you do want to stick with a top loader, there are some much more efficient top loaders on the market out there now as well. And the best advice I can give is to start out by looking at the Energy Star label. The Energy Star label now includes requirements for energy use as well as water consumption, so you can find units that save on both of those fronts. And then if you want to go, once you've narrowed your field of inquiry down to just Energy Star units, you may want to take a look at the Yellow Energy Guide label and look at the overall operating costs each year, and you'll see that there's still quite a bit of variation, and you can try to pick one that has among the lower energy costs to get the most efficient model even within Energy Star. And we have a lot more on clothes washers on our website.
Okay, I hope that helps the listener there. Next, we're going to go to Paris, Illinois. Listener on line 4. Hi.
Hi. Just wanted to bring a point up. We were recently here in Paris thinking about maybe trying to start a program to offer the public the compact fluorescent light bulbs. And right after we started talking about that, I recently read an article in Scientific America where those are just the same as the long tube fluorescent light bulbs. And the state of Illinois has passed a law where it is against the law to put those into a dumpster. And so started trying to flag down a place to dispose of these properly. And here in the lower part of Illinois, there's just nothing available. And so I wasn't even aware. I've been putting these in my house for, about a year now. We've been switching over our bulbs, you know, because there was so much talk about how efficient they were and it's great for the environment, da-da-da-da, to find out that they have mercury and you have to be careful if they break and there's a gas that comes out and it's not good for you. And I just wanted to make the point that I think the industry needs to make it clear to the public what these are and how they are to be disposed of properly, because I don't think people know it. All you hear is about the good part of it. You don't hear anybody saying anything about, you know, proper disposable and just the issues that there is with mercury with these. Even though it is a minute amount, everybody's adds up in the end. And I would like to hear your opinion of that and if there's any work being done on trying to get some kind of way to dispose of these properly for the general public. And I'll listen off air. Thank you.
Another great question.
That is a great question. And there are a lot of concerns, and I know there's been an increasing amount of press and people talking about the issues of mercury with compact fluorescent lamps. And the first thing that I would point out, I think it's very important for people to keep in mind, electric power generation is the leading source of mercury in the environment. And any mercury that comes from a power plant is dispersed out into the environment. It can't be captured. And it's largely responsible for mercury deposition into our lakes and streams and is affecting, leading to mercury buildup in fish stocks and other problems that create public health issues. So what a lot of people have done is said, well, is the amount of mercury in a compact fluorescent bulb, is it equal to, less than, greater than the amount of mercury that is emitted from the electricity used to power that light bulb or the light bulb that it's replacing? And it turns out that the amount of mercury that's actually in the compact fluorescent lamp is about the same or somewhat less than the mercury that would be emitted from the power plant by using an incandescent lamp instead of the compact fluorescent. So on the mercury question, the compact fluorescent is actually reducing, keeping the same or slightly reducing mercury, overall mercury in the environment. And the great thing is, since the bulbs can be captured and recycled, you can get that mercury out and it's not just being put out into the environment. But, of course, then that begs the question, mm-hmm. how do we get rid of these lamps so that, that can happen, so that mercury can be captured and it doesn't get released out into the environment? And so that is definitely a something that a lot of people are working on right now, particularly because there is an interest in making these products much more widely available and much more widely used. So we're seeing that in across the country, some large retailers, most notably IKEA, is accepting compact fluorescent bulbs for recycle, even if you didn't buy them at IKEA, at their stores. So if you have an IKEA in your area that you can go to, you can freely dispose of your lamps there. But, of course, I know there aren't that many IKEA stores, and many people in many parts of the country don't have access. So the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and a number of other organizations are working together to try to find additional retail partners that will allow consumers to bring compact fluorescents back to their businesses for recycling. I think everyone should contact their local government and tell them that they would like to see compact fluorescent lamp disposal locations in their town. Tell them that, you know, they want to use these bulbs, they don't want to put them into the waste stream, and they would like the city to work with them to find a way to dispose of them, you know, whether that would be special drop-off locations around town, just like we have for other recycled goods, mm-hmm. or even at the, you know, maybe as a first start, you could have a place to collect them at the landfill, and that should be easy enough and a good way to start before you had more facilities around the community. But one of the great things is, and I like to remind people of this as well, a compact fluorescent lamp lasts 6 to 10 times longer than an incandescent lamp. So the nice thing is you're not going to have as many of these things hanging around to be thrown away at your house as you do with the incandescent bulbs that you've been using for so many years. So at least it's not, we're not talking about the same volume of lamps to be disposed of in a given year as you would with your typical light bulb. So that at least makes it a little bit better. And I would encourage people to go to the EPA's website, the Energy Star website at energystar.gov. They have more information. You can also visit lamprecycle.org, and they'll have up-to-date information and help you find places in your own community where you can dispose of the lamps properly. And the last thing I would say is if you do break a compact fluorescent, what you want to do is, you know, there was a story circulating on the internet saying that, you know, you have to call in a hazmat contractor and all this stuff, and you really don't have to go that far. What you want to do is, you know, open a window, let the lamp break and settle for 10 or 15 minutes, come back to it, you know, keep your kids away from it, and use cardboard or paper to scoop up the breakage. Bag it in a plastic bag, and you can dispose of that in your trash. You know, it's we don't want the whole volume of compact fluorescents out there to end up in the waste stream, but certainly if you have one that's broken that you need to dispose of, you can feel safe disposing of that in your garbage if it's just wrapped in a plastic bag. So I think it's just a matter of common sense.
Let's take another call now. A listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi, I once read an article that said the time of day in which you use appliances like televisions, washers and dryers, and garbage dishwashers had an effect on energy consumption. If I remember vaguely, say using the these appliances between 1 p.m. and 6 p.m. was the most inefficient time, whereby using them, say, at 12 midnight to 8 a.m. was the most efficient time, and the other one was right in the middle. Is there any truth to that?
Yeah, I think the question there is not the efficiency of the actual appliance that you're operating, but rather the impact that it has on our overall electrical system. As you can imagine, the hours between 1 and 6 in the afternoon, particularly in the summer months, are when it's hottest and you have the highest demand for electricity, largely to meet the air conditioning load and because you have all these businesses that are operating and they're running their lights and computers and everything else that's electrical. So you have a very high peak demand at those times of the day. So what, you know, usually what we try to encourage people to do is if you have an energy use that you can put off and do in the evening or even overnight, like you can run your dishwasher overnight instead of in the middle of the day, by doing so, you're helping to reduce that overall big push of demand in the middle of the day, and so our electrical system is better able to meet everybody's needs, and it allows us to have to lower our need for overall what we call peak output. So your actual appliance will work just efficiently at those times, but it has more of an impact on our overall electrical system. Related to that, I would say, particularly in the summer months, if you want to run your dishwasher, your clothes dryer, or any appliance that creates additional heat, if you can run it overnight or later in the evening, you'll be introducing less extra heat to your house that your air conditioner then has to help work harder to get rid of.
Yeah, and there's a program that some utilities are offering where you can reduce, hopefully, your electric bill with a program called Power Smart Pricing. So that might be something for that gentleman to look into
as well.
Oh, absolutely.
Contact your utilities because that type of pricing is becoming more and more common, and more places are starting to use that as an incentive to get people to shift. You'll pay a lower price per kilowatt hour for your energy if you use it off-peak.
Okay. Let's take one more call this afternoon, line 2, a listener in Muhammad, but we'll have to kind of hurry it along a little bit here this afternoon. Line 2, Muhammad, hi.
Hi. Great show. I have more than halved our power bill by doing many of the things you say. I have the top-loading washer, the moisture-sensing dryer, and the compact fluorescent bulbs throughout the house. And we bought a more efficient air conditioner. We went up, I believe, to 12 SEER. And that has made so much difference. Our highest power bill this summer was $125. And for me, that was really impressive because that's down from $250. And I just wanted to ask you if you would speak to corn stoves, too, which we've just started using a corn/wood pellet stove in our great room. And we love it. It's so clean, and it's attractive, and it's so nice in the morning to be able to stand next to something and warm yourself up a little toasty, you know, like in the old days.
Okay.
So I'll listen.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, well, congratulations on the success you've had improving the efficiency of your home. I think it's great for people to hear from a consumer like them that what's really possible. I have to admit, I don't know a whole lot about the corn and wood pellet stoves. I can say that there are systems on the market now that are very high efficiency, and I know that in a number of neighborhoods that I'm aware of, people have gone in and purchased the stoves for their homes, and they actually share in purchasing. They've created kind of a co-op to get the corn or the wood pellets for those stoves. So you want to buy a higher efficiency new unit, and certainly they can save you a lot of energy, particularly if they allow you to cut back heating through the rest of the home. You know, in the evenings when you're hanging out and the family's all together, if you can cut back the heat from the rest heating the rest of the house while you're in the room with the stove, that's a really great option. And it's a great alternative to traditional fireplaces, which can often end up using more energy and can create a bit of a drain on your overall home system and are also a big source of loss, air loss in your home.
Okay. There, we've got to leave it. We're out of time. Jennifer, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon. You really know your stuff.
Thanks so much, Celeste. I really enjoyed it.
Jennifer Thorne Amon is with the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy, and she is one of the authors of the Consumer Guide to Home Energy Savings. The acronym for this organization, the American Council, is ACEEE. You can find a condensed online version of the guide at www.acee, those are those three E's, .org/consumer guide. Consumer Guide, the publication, the in-print publication, is published by New Society Publishers.